I want to talk to you this morning about babies. Now, I raise the topic of babies because, believe it or not, our study passage this morning, chapters 7, 8, and 9 of Isaiah, is overflowing with them. No fewer than 4 children are mentioned in these chapters. One of them is admittedly of indeterminate age, but the other 3 are explicitly defined for us as newborn infants, as babies. Between the 4 of them, this juvenile quartet form the linking theme that unites what would otherwise be an extremely difficult and complex passage of the Bible. As I hope we shall see, these 4 babies give Isaiah 7 to 9 a remarkable coherence. And if you want a key verse to fasten your attention on throughout the entire study, it's chapter 8, verse 18, where we find Isaiah the prophet saying, "Here am I, and the children the Lord has given me. We are signs and symbols in Israel from the Lord Almighty, who dwells on Mount Zion." That proves, you see, that it's no coincidence that this baby motif keeps recurring in this part of Isaiah. It's a deliberate device on the part of the prophet. His own children were, he says, signs and symbols from the Lord Almighty. Now, it's not uncommon in the Old Testament for the prophets to use visual aids in communicating their message. And sometimes those visual aids were members of their own family. Hosea is a classic example of that. He was told, some of you may remember, to marry a prostitute, of all things, as a kind of dramatic symbol of the way that God had committed himself in covenant love to Israel, who was committing spiritual adultery against him. Interestingly, the children of Hosea, the children of that unhappy marriage, are given names that have relevance to Hosea's preaching ministry. But I think not even the prophet Hosea uses babies in quite the way Isaiah does. Because it isn't just the names of these 4 children that occur in Isaiah 7, 8, and 9 that are signs and symbols of the Lord Almighty, though that is part of it. No, the actual fact that they are children is significant too. Like the prophet he is, what we find here is Isaiah reaching forward under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit into the future. He's been given insight about God's plan of salvation in the long term. His reflection on the situation of his own day, and particularly on the role his children had in addressing that situation, provide a kind of seedbed for a remarkable insight he's given. He foresees that dreadful days lie ahead for Judah. But on the other side of that national catastrophe, he foresees something else. Hope. Deliverance. The kingdom of God. And surprising as it may seem, says Isaiah, the signal that will mark the arrival of that new dawn for the people of God, that kingdom, will not be some event of military or political importance. It will be the birth of a baby. It will be the gift of a son, a child, not unlike these children I've been given, says Isaiah, as signs and symbols from the Lord Almighty. Well, will you come with me then and trace the course of Isaiah's extraordinary intuition in this matter? We've called our study Infant Sermons and Saviours. And at the end, maybe we should be a little clearer as to just why it was Jesus said that unless we become like little children, we shan't enter the kingdom of heaven. Let's start then with baby number 1 in chapter 7, verses 1 to 13. This is Isaiah's firstborn son, who may not have been a baby at all because his age isn't given to us. But his name is Shear Yashuv, 2 words meaning a remnant shall return. Look at the beginning of chapter 7. When Ahaz, son of Jotham, son of Uzziah, was king of Judah, King Rezin of Aram and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, marched up to fight against Jerusalem, but they could not overpower it. Now the house of David was told, "Aram has allied itself with Ephraim." So the hearts of Ahaz and his people were shaken as the trees of the forest are shaken by the wind. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, "Go out, you and your son, Shear Yashuv, to meet Ahaz at the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the washerman's field. Say to him, 'Be careful, keep calm, and don't be afraid.'" Now, the historical background to these three chapters is obviously important, or Isaiah's scribe wouldn't have specified it in the careful way he does in these opening verses of chapter 7. But the outline he gives us is rather sparse, isn't it? Fortunately, we can fill out the details of this period of history considerably from the parallel accounts we find in 2 Kings, chapter 16, and 2 Chronicles, chapter 28. So let me tell you briefly what the circumstances were when we put it all together. Around the middle of the 8th century before Christ, a military genius called, believe it or not, Tiglath-Pileser III, seized the throne of Assyria, a great power to the east of Judah. And he began to mobilize the vast military resources of Assyria with the clear ambition of conquering the entire Middle East. He was a kind of Napoleon of the ancient world with Tiglath-Pileser. Well, understandably, the smaller kingdoms of the area had to think fast about how they were going to respond to this challenge. Basically, they only had two alternatives. Some of them took the line that discretion was the better part of valor. They opted to pay off Tiglath-Pileser with tribute money and accept the status of a vassal state within his Assyrian empire. But others were of a more fiercely nationalistic temperament and decided on a policy of armed resistance. Now, two kings of this latter stamp were the two who are mentioned in these verses. Rezin, king of Syria, but called here Aram, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel. Now, it's important to remember that Israel and Judah were two different countries at this time in their history. They'd been split by a civil war after the death of Solomon, and relations between them were very strained. The prophet Isaiah, who wrote this book, he lived in Judah, the smaller southern province of that split kingdom. And there, the royal dynasty of David still held power, albeit over a much diminished realm. And the present heir of David's throne was called Ahaz. His name, you see, is mentioned there. Son of Jotham, grandson of Uzziah. Well, this is what happened. Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, king of the northern province of Israel, they realized the only way they could possibly keep the Assyrian menace at bay was by a kind of NATO alliance. United, we little countries will fall, may stand, they said, but divided, we shall fall. So let's form an alliance against the Assyrians. But unfortunately, these two on their own couldn't possibly muster sufficient forces to deter Tiglath-Pileser's aggression. So they put pressure on Judah, the southern province, to come and join them in a three-pronged coalition, Syria, Israel, and Judah. But Judah said no. Jotham, Ahaz's father, had preferred to retain Judah's independence among what we would call today the non-aligned nations. Well, Rezin and Pekah weren't prepared to accept Judah's refusal. It was as simple as that. For it left a breach in their defensive wall against Assyria, and Tiglath-Pileser would be sure to exploit it. So sometime around 735 BC, very soon after Jotham's death and Ahaz's accession to the throne, they sent a joint expeditionary force south to attack Judah, to depose Ahaz, and to put a puppet prince on the throne of Judah in his stead called Tabeel. If Judah wouldn't join their Western Asian treaty organization voluntarily, he would be made to join it by force. That was their attitude. And it seems from these early verses of Isaiah 7 that this encounter between the prophet Isaiah and King Ahaz took place just as Jerusalem was preparing herself to face this joint Israel-Syrian assault. Ahaz may well have been at the aqueduct that we're told about in verse 3, because he was inspecting the water supply for the city of Jerusalem to see what chance there was of surviving a siege. Certainly the text leaves us in no doubt that he was a very worried man. The hearts of Ahaz and his people were shaken as the trees of the forest are shaken by the wind, we're told. But what I want you to notice is Isaiah's response to this anxiety his king was experiencing. Go out, you and your son Shear Jashub, to meet Ahab at the end of the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the washerman's field and say to him, be careful, keep calm, don't be afraid. Do not lose heart because of these two smouldering stubs of firewood, because of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram and of the son of Remaliah. Aram, Ephraim, and Remaliah, son of Clotij, your ruins, saying, let us invade Judah, let us tear it apart and divide it among ourselves, and make the son of Tabeel king over it. Yet this is what the sovereign Lord says. It will not take place. It will not happen. So Isaiah is absolutely convinced that the king's fears are unnecessary. It's not going to happen, he says. Rezin and Pekah's plot to overthrow you will fail. Don't be intimidated by their threats then. Now, why was Isaiah so sure about that? Well, it was all tied up in the name of his son, this child that God told him to take along with him to this critical interview with the king, Shear Yashub. A remnant will return. See, God had revealed his plan for Judah's history to the prophet. He knew what the future held. God had told him. Now, true, much of what it held was very bad. Conquest, exile, this would be the penalty that God's judgment would exact on the sinfulness and pride of Judah. Isaiah has told us about that in earlier chapters. But there would also be hope, for the promise of God was that there would be a small company of believers who would survive and who would eventually repopulate the land. Among them, an heir of David's throne, which could not be lost in the purposes of God. Hence the name of his child, a remnant shall return. But perhaps most important of all, as Isaiah understood it, this whole scenario of the divine purpose did not include Syria or Israel. Neither of these countries had any role to play. That's why he's so sure, you see, that Ahaz didn't need to be afraid of them. Rezin and Pekah, he says, these angry young men of the Middle East, they're not so much firebrands as firewood, he said. A couple of charred twigs from the bonfire, that's all they are. They may create a few sparks, generate a little smoke. But in military terms, they are lightweights. As far as the history of the world goes, they are political non-entities. Don't be panicked by them. Keep calm. Ignore their saber rattling. Their threats are empty. Their policies are doomed. My son here, Shear Yashub, he's a testimony to the certainty of God's plan. If only you're willing to accept it, Ahaz. The royal house of David won't be usurped. A remnant shall return. What you've got to do, Ahaz, is to stop trembling and start trusting. God's in control of the situation. He is the sovereign Lord. You've got to have faith, Your Majesty. So we find him in verse 9 saying, if you don't stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. But I fear faith was something Ahaz had very little of. A descendant of David he may have been, but he had none of his forebears' spirituality. See how he responds to the prophet's challenge to faith. Verse 10, again the Lord spoke to Ahaz, ask the Lord your God for a sign, whether in the deepest depths or in the highest heights. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, I will not put the Lord to the test. Now on the surface, I suppose, Ahaz's refusal here to ask God for a sign sounds very laudable, especially when you realize he's quoting a text from the book of Deuteronomy when he says, I will not put the Lord to the test. But it's clear from Isaiah's response that his attitude was not as pious as it seemed. You see, when the Bible says, do not put the Lord to the test, what it's prohibiting is the sort of mentality that wants to solicit signs from God as a condition for faith, to give God an ultimatum. I won't believe unless you work a miracle for me, God. Some people sometimes say that to you, don't they? And that's not allowed. God won't be put in that position. But what was happening here in verse 10 of Isaiah 7 is quite different from that. Here, God himself, through his prophet, is offering a sign to this nervous and vacillating king. Look, he says graciously, I know you're afraid. I know it's hard to trust me in a situation as desperate as this. I'm prepared to make a concession in such circumstances. tell me what would convince you that my sovereign control of history is dependable. Do you want me to write my signature in the sky? Do you want me to generate an earthquake under your feet? I want you to believe in me, Ahaz. It's important you believe in me, Ahaz. And I'm willing to make it as easy as possible for you to believe in me, Ahaz. Ask the Lord your God for a sign, whether in the deepest depths or in the highest heights. But Ahaz says, no. Not, no, I believe in you anyway, God. There's no need to give me a sign. But no, I'm not going to believe in you, God, and nothing you could do would ever persuade me otherwise. That's Ahaz's attitude. We know, in fact, from the accounts of 2 Kings 16, that Ahaz had come to a decision. Not for him the path of humble faith, which Isaiah was recommending. No, Ahaz had already chosen instead the path of diplomatic maneuver. Do you know what plan was gelling in his devious little mind just as Isaiah came up to talk to him? You can read all about it in 2 Kings 16. Ahaz had decided to plunder the treasure from the temple of Jerusalem, to send the gold he acquired as a result as tribute money to whom? To Tiglath-Pileser III, king of Assyria, and include with this tribute money a little message. Dear Tiglath-Pileser, Sir, Your Majesty, I am being besieged by the armies of Syria and Israel. Please come and save me. Here's something for your trouble. Yours grovelingly, Ahaz. Like a third world government today might beg assistance from the USA or the USSR to resist an external foe, Ahaz had decided he was going to shelter under the umbrella of the superpower. Just wait till Rezin and Pekar find the Assyrian army on their doorstep. They'll smile on the other side of their faces then. I suspect he was chuckling to himself rather grimly, even as Isaiah met him. And he thought up the plan. Who needs faith when for the price of a few gold bars you can get Tiglath-Pileser III on your side? But Isaiah was not impressed. Oh, he knew what Ahaz was planning. He knew why Ahaz wasn't interested in a sign. And he knew what God thought of it. Look at verse 13. Hear now, you house of David. Is it not enough to try the patience of men? Will you try the patience of my God also? You notice the change of possessive pronouns there. In verse 11 it was, ask the Lord your God for a sign. Now Isaiah speaks of trying the patience of my God. Clear suggestion is that his God was not Ahaz's God anymore. He's given you every opportunity to trust him, Ahaz. He would willingly supply whatever supernatural credentials you required, but you aren't interested. You've made up your mind. You reckon the army of Assyria better insurance policy than the God of Israel. Well, you've had your chance, Ahaz. God's patience with you is now exhausted. Since you will not accept his offer of a sign to strengthen your faith, he will give you a sign to seal your fate. And that brings us to baby number two. Look at chapter 7, verse 14. Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son. And we'll call him Emmanuel. He will eat curds and honey when he knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right. But before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, the land of the two kings you dread will be laid waste. The Lord will bring on you and on your people and on the house of your father a time unlike any since Ephraim broke away from Judah. He will bring the king of Assyria. Now there are a few passages in the whole book of Isaiah that have occasioned more controversy and more debate than these few verses, which in a sense is strange because on the surface the text seems to present no problems at all. A male baby was about to be conceived by a young woman, says Isaiah, and his name would be Emmanuel, that is, God with us. Long before this child was grown to the age of discretion, the immediate crisis that was causing Ahaz so much anxiety would all be over. Pekah and Rezin would be finished. But in the place of those two kings, a far worse international peril would be threatening Judah, he says. And ironically, Ahaz, it will be the very power to whom you are looking for protection, the king of Assyria. In the verses that follow, Isaiah proceeds to develop this prediction further. First, with a metaphor of an infestation of insects. Look at verse 18. In that day the Lord will whistle for flies from the distant streams of Egypt and for bees from the land of Assyria, and they will all come and settle in the steep ravines and in the crevices in the rocks, on all the thorn bushes and at all the water holes. In other words, a power struggle between the military giants of Assyria and Egypt is going to take place. And it's all going to be played out on the territory of Judah, rather like France in the First World War. Swarms of foreign troops, like plagues of insects, would overrun the land, monopolizing the military strongholds and all the vital water supplies. It's not going to be fun for your people, Ahaz, argues Isaiah. There'll be the meat in the sandwich between Egypt and Assyria. But it's not going to be fun for you personally either. And that brings him to his second metaphor, a metaphor of the barber's shop. Look at verse 20. In that day the Lord will use a razor hired from beyond the river, the king of Assyria, to shave your head and the hair of your legs and to take off your beard also. Notice that phrase, hired from beyond the river, you see. That's a sarcastic allusion to this tribute money that Ahaz was planning to pay to Tiglath-Pileser. You think you're hiring an army to deliver you. On the contrary, says Isaiah, you're just hiring the instrument of your own humiliation. An instrument who will strip all the dignity of your manhood from you and expose you for the pathetic weakling you are. And as for your realm, Ahaz, the land of Judah, well, years of constant army maneuvers and looting by foreign troops will turn it all back to the wilderness. That's what will happen. Verse 21. In that day, a man will keep alive a young cow and two goats, and because of the abundance of the milk they give, he will have curds to eat. All who remain in the land will eat curds and honey. And in that day, in every place where there were 1,000 vines worth 1,000 silver shekels, there will be only briars and thorns. A picture of economic devastation or of Arcadian bliss here, depending on how you feel about the simple lifestyle. People are going to be forced to live on a diet of dairy produce and wild honey, he says. That's all there'll be. Oh, there'll be plenty to go around, that's one thing, because the population will be so decimated. But all the vineyards and the cultivated fields in which Judah's property magnates had been investing so much capital, they will all have reverted back to the bush. Indeed, men will have to become hunters and semi-nomadic herdsmen, just like they were once before. Men will go out with bow and arrow, he says, verse 24, for the land will be covered with briars and thorns. And as for the hills once cultivated by the hoe, you will no longer go there for fear of the briars and the thorns. They will become places where cattle are turned loose and where sheep run. Well, I think you see the general drift of this last half of chapter 7 from verse 14 onwards. It's quite obvious. Ahaz is refusing to put God to the test, but in doing so, he has failed his own test. He's forfeited his last chance. His decision to put his trust in Assyria rather than God would backfire on him most horribly and reduce him and the land of Judah to nothing. The economy would be reduced to subsistence level within the space of a single generation, says Isaiah. And the birth of Emmanuel would be the divine proof that all this was going to happen within the lifetime of this child. And yet, you see, there is more to baby number two than just that. Unresolved questions orbit around this tantalizing and mysterious figure, Emmanuel. Not the least being, who is he? Who is this strange child? Now, scholars have suggested all kinds of answers to that. Some say Isaiah is just implying that Emmanuel is going to become a popular name for children born in the near future. In their relief that the threat from Syria and Israel has been averted, women will christen their children. God with us, he's saying. That's one explanation. Others say that Isaiah is referring to Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, the king, who probably was not yet born, but who was going to turn out to be a godly and believing monarch, one whom God would be with, in contrast to the apostasy and unbelief of his father. But as far as the immediate context of Isaiah is concerned, I think it has to be said that by far the most obvious explanation of this Emmanuel child has to be to identify him with baby number 3 in Isaiah's quartet. Let's look at baby number 3 now, and you'll see what I mean. That takes us into chapter 8. The Lord said to me, take a large scroll and write on it with an ordinary pen, Maher Shalal Hashbaz. And I will call in Uriah the priest and Zechariah son of Jeberechiah as reliable witnesses for me. And then I went to the prophetess, and she conceived and gave birth to a son. And the Lord said to me, name him Mahashal al-Hashbaz. Before the boy knows how to say my father or my mother, the wealth of Damascus and the plunder of Samaria will be carried off by the king of Assyria. Now the similarity between the accounts of this birth of Isaiah's second son and his predictions about Emmanuel, I think, are too many to be coincidental. And in particular, just compare that phrase we find in chapter 7, verse 16, with a similar one we find in 8, verse 4. Before the boy knows enough to reject the wrong and choose the right, he says of Emmanuel. Before the boy knows how to say my father and my mother, he says of Mahashal al-Hashbaz. Now, the parallel there seems very clear, and one would have thought quite intentional. What's more, these two children seem to be regarded as prophetic symbols of exactly the same historical events, namely the collapse of the Syrian-Israelite coalition and the invasion of Judah by this greater menace of Assyria. In fact, in verses 6 to 8 of chapter 8, Isaiah expands on the meaning of Mahashal al-Hashbaz in a way very similar to the way he develops the implications of the Emmanuel child back in chapter 7, the only difference being that instead of using the metaphor of insects or a razor, he uses the metaphor of a flash flood. Look at verse 6. Because this people has rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloah and rejoices over Rezin and the son of Remaliah, therefore the Lord is about to bring against them the mighty flood waters of the river, the king of Assyria with all his pomp. It will overflow its channels, run over all its banks, and sweep on into Judah, swirling over it, passing through it, and reaching up to the neck. Now what the prophet is doing here is he's likening the resources of Judah's own religion and culture to the rather unimpressive little brook that provided Jerusalem with its fresh water, the waters of Shiloah, as it was called. It was probably this very stream Ahaz was examining when Isaiah met him at the beginning. No doubt the king had come to the conclusion that the waters of Shiloah were inadequate. The city's water supply could not sustain a siege. And that had been the final factor that had determined him to seek protection from Assyria, rather than to face the Syrian-Israelite army alone. What Isaiah is saying here, in the short term, your political ploy will be successful, Ahaz. You will rejoice over these two petty monarchs, Rezin and Pekah. But your glee at their downfall will be all too short-lived. Because as a direct result of your refusal to trust the resources God has given you, the waters of Shiloah, you are going to be deluged by the very same flood of imperialist expansionism that engulfs them. You reject Jerusalem's own brook, God is going to bring upon you the mighty water of the river Euphrates, he says. So overwhelming will that flood of Assyrian invasion be, that Judah's going to finish up like a drowning man, almost totally submerged, with just his head gasping for air above the rising tide. You see how he puts that? Passing through and reaching up to the neck. What are the similarities to the picture drawn in chapter 7 of enemy occupation, of national humiliation, of devastation of Judah's population? It's all easy to see. What's more, Isaiah seems to further confirm the identification between this second son, Mahashal al-Hashbaz, and Emmanuel by reintroducing the latter's name in verse 8. Do you notice that? Its outspread wings will cover the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel, he says. In other words, in the lifetime of the next generation, this frightening flood of military conquest will spread like the wings of a huge bird of prey and cover the entire breadth of Judah, your land, O Emmanuel, he says. Now, do you see what I mean when I say that babies 2 and 3 in Isaiah's quartet do seem at the very least to be very close relatives, don't they? Yet convenient as it would be to identify Mahashalal Hashbaz and Emmanuel, I'm afraid it isn't as simple as that. Let me tell you why. First, Mahashalal Hashbaz, I think we'll have to call him Mash for short, or I'm going to run out of spit, doesn't precisely fit the terms of the Emmanuel prophecy. Just look back at them again, 7 verse 14. The Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will be with child. Now, there's been endless debate about that word virgin, and it has to be said that the Hebrew word is not the specific word for virgin, which is available in Hebrew. It's a word that perhaps would be slightly more accurately translated in English, maiden. It means a young woman of marriageable age who has not yet had a baby. Isaiah then is not necessarily implying anything supernatural about this conception. But he is implying that it will be the first pregnancy of the woman concerned. But Mash wasn't his mother's first child. The text quite clearly implies he was Isaiah's second son. Why then should Isaiah be led to use that word virgin or maiden if he was referring to his own wife? That seems quite inconsistent. Secondly, and of course very obviously, the names aren't the same. I mean, if Emmanuel and Mash are one and the same child, why does Israel go to such extraordinary lengths to advertise the latter's name as Mahashalal Hashbaz? Why doesn't he just say he's Emmanuel, the one I told you about? Surely that would make more sense. And thirdly, not only are the names not the same, but perhaps most significant of all, the names convey a radically different message. You see, Mahashalal Hashbaz means quick to the plunder, swift to the spoil, as you'll see in the margin. It's a warning of the rapidity of the Assyrian invasion and of the disastrous effects that invasion is going to have, not only on the economies of Damascus and Samaria, but eventually on Jerusalem too. It's a rather pessimistic name. But Emmanuel isn't a pessimistic name. Emmanuel means God is with us. And in the Old Testament, that sort of phrase, God is with us, was always a declaration of confidence in the certainty of divine deliverance. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge, says the psalmist. Psalm 46 could almost be written as a meditation, actually, on this passage. God is with us, used as a Hebrew idiom, is a confession of faith and hope. It's a name that looks beyond the devastation of war to salvation, a salvation that God will achieve for his covenant people. God is with us. And the interesting thing is that with the second mention of the name Emmanuel in chapter 8, verse 8, the whole direction of Isaiah's prophecy swings suddenly in that more hopeful direction. Just notice that. Raise the war cry, verse 9. Raise the war cry, you nations, and be shattered. Listen, all you distant lands. Prepare for battle and be shattered. Prepare for battle and be shattered. Devise your strategy, but it will be thwarted. Propose your plan, but it will not stand. For Emmanuel, God is with us. See, Isaiah here is throwing down the gauntlet to the nations. Syria, Israel, Assyria, come on, the lot of you, he says. You're spoiling for a fight? Well, come and do your worst. You're confident about your political connivings? Well, put your plots into action. We're not afraid of you. But in the last analysis, you will be shattered. Your armies will be defeated. Your strategies will be frustrated. Do you know why? Because of Emmanuel. Because God is with us. So we're introduced to the last and most thrilling section of our study passage of all, the baby number 4. The baby to whom Isaiah's two sons and this mysterious Emmanuel child all point, but who in a sense transcends all three of them. A baby who, from Isaiah's historical perspective, lay still in the distant future, but who for us, this morning, is the central pivot of our worship and of our Christian faith. 9 verse 6. To us a child is born. To us a son is given. And the government will be on his shoulders. This, of course, is one of the most famous prophecies of the birth of Christ in the whole of the Bible. We're all familiar with it, even if it's only from the strains of Handel's Messiah. But what I want you to notice is that it doesn't just fall out of the air into Isaiah 9. This famous prophecy is in fact the culmination of Isaiah's babies. The fourth of this juvenile quartet. And it comes to Isaiah quite clearly in the context of a very intense personal experience of reflection on the significance of those children. If you look back at 8 verse 11 again, you'll see that once again we've entered an autobiographical part of Isaiah's prophecy. He's talking in the first person, just like he was back in chapter 6 when we studied that vision he had in the temple, you remember. The Lord spoke to me with his strong hand upon me, warning me not to follow the way of this people, he writes. Clearly then, Isaiah here is testifying to a most moving and profound prophetic experience, the hand of God upon him, almost tangibly. And you see what he says. Do not call conspiracy everything these people call conspiracy. Do not fear what they fear. Do not dread it. The Lord Almighty is the one you are to regard as holy. He is the one you are to fear. He is the one you are to dread. He will be a sanctuary for both houses of Israel. He will be a stone that causes men to stumble and a rock that makes them fall. And for the people of Jerusalem, he will be a trap and a snare. Many of them will stumble. They will fall and be broken. They will be snared and captured. Now, in simple terms, what God is telling Isaiah here is what, in fact, he intimated to him at the time of that prophetic calling in the temple, that the people of Judah are not going to pay attention to his preaching. Just like Ahaz, the king, they aren't going to put their trust in God during the coming international crisis. Quite to the contrary, in their obsession with political intrigue, they're going to become increasingly anxiety-ridden, and the faith of their forefathers is going to sit further and further away from them, he says. Instead of finding salvation from God, the divine judgment on their unbelief is going to be the very cause of their downfall. And great numbers of Jewish people will perish as a result, he says. Many of them will stumble, they will fall and be broken, they will be snared and captured. But, says the Lord to Isaiah his prophet, you are to be different. You're to be a rugged individualist, remember? You're to stand out from the crowd. Don't go their way. No matter how universal this drift towards religious apostasy seems to be, you are not to fall victim to it, Isaiah. You're to keep away from this national paranoia about conspiracy. You're not to be afraid of what they fear. You're not to dread it. No, you're to remember that vision of the real king that you had that day in the temple, high and lifted up. You're to remember how you felt when you trembled at the song of the angels. Holy, holy, holy. The Lord Almighty is the one you are to regard as holy. He's the one you're to fear. He's the one you are to dread. For you see, Isaiah, what you've got to understand is that your ministry is not really intended for your own generation. Your own contemporaries are so hardened in their unbelief, there's no hope for them. They are doomed to fall and be broken. Now your eyes, Isaiah, like the prophet you are, must be fixed on the future. You've got a job to do, a job which serves not your own people, but generations yet to come. Here's what you've got to do. First, you've got to preserve the revelation of God preserve it for generations to come. Look at verse 16. Bind up the testimony. Seal up the law among my disciples. I will wait for the Lord who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob. I will put my trust in him. In other words, keep the Bible safe. Bind up the testimony. Seal up the law. Don't let this period of national apostasy result in the loss of God's precious word, Isaiah. Nurture that tiny group of believing followers you've got. And in that little community of faith you and they form together, keep the Bible safe. That's the first thing you must do. Second thing you must do, Isaiah, don't get sidetracked into occultism. Look at verse 19. When men tell you to consult mediums and spiritists who whisper and mutter, should not a people inquire of their God? Why consult the dead on behalf of the living? To the law and to the testimony. If they do not speak according to this word, they have no light of dawn. This is important text. When people give up believing in the true God, you see, they don't believe in nothing. They believe in anything. The spiritual dimension of our human personality can't be denied. It can only be repressed. And repressed spirituality simply reemerges in a perverted form, as superstition, as magic, as spiritualism. In the days to come, warns God, the temptation for people to turn to such occult practices for reassurance will be immense. And if you, Isaiah, and your disciples are not to be seduced into that path, you must check everything by the Bible, to the law and to the testimony. Check everything by that Bible you're looking after. Because if the things people say don't accord with God's written revelation, then any light they may claim to shed on man's dark night of despair is a false light, a deceitful light. They have no real light of dawn. A light designed to lure men onto the rocks of shipwreck rather than to secure them on the rock of salvation. That's the second thing you are to do then. You are to make sure you don't get sidetracked into occultism. And the third thing you are to do, Isaiah, you are to be patient. Verse 17, I will wait for the Lord who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob. I will put my trust in him. Nobody else will, Isaiah, but you will put your trust in him. That's what you've got to do. Dark days are ahead. A dark age, you could almost call it. A period when the people of God will feel quite literally God forsaken. They will be days of deprivation, full of pain and anger and impenetrable hopelessness. Little wonder the people will grasp at the straws of occultism, because only faith will dare to walk boldly in such darkness, and faith will be in short supply. See how he describes it in verse 21? Distressed and hungry, they will roam through the land. When they are famished, they will become enraged, and looking upward will curse their king and their God. Then they will look toward the earth and see only distress and darkness and fearful gloom, and they will be thrust into utter darkness. Oh, it's going to be a bleak day. But be patient, Isaiah. And teach your school of disciples after you to be patient. I will put my trust in him. For light will dawn. Those children I've given you, they are signs and symbols of a light that is coming, my light. And if you like, I'll even tell you where the first glimmer of that radiance will be seen. Look at the beginning of chapter 9. Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who are in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, but in the future, he will honor Galilee of the Gentiles by the way of the sea, along the Jordan. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, light has dawned. Galilee, then, the very place where the impact of the Assyrian invasion was worst, that would be the day which one day would be famous for a different reason. The people walking in darkness would see a great light there. You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people at the harvest, as men rejoice when dividing the plunder, he says. Like the joy, then, of gathering a harvest or winning a victory. Like the sense of liberation, he says in verse 4, that Israel felt in the day of Gideon, when Gideon with his handful of men defeated the Midianites. Like the wave of relief, he says in verse 5, when a war-torn land is at last allowed to put all the blood-stained army uniforms in the incinerators, every warrior's boot used in battle, every garment rolled in blood, destined for burning, to be fuel for the fire. And just that way, the people of God, he says, will experience joy and liberation and relief from all their fears. The darkness will pass away. As dawn disperses the terrors of the night, God will disperse the darkness enshrouding his people, the shadow of death, as he calls it. And here is the remarkable thing. The thing which Isaiah suddenly saw, which marks him out as such an extraordinary prophet of the Old Testament. The signal for this great salvation, this great dawn, would not be a historic event like politics or some military victory. It wouldn't be something that Ahaz would understand or could manipulate. No, it would all begin with something as insignificant, something as weak, as the birth of a baby. The baby we've called baby number 4, but who is in fact baby number 1 by a very wide margin. To us a child is born. To us a son is given. The government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Not unusual for kings in the ancient world to receive rather exaggerated titles at their coronation, but there's no way, I think, of evading the supernatural implications of these titles that we read in verse 6. This child will exhibit miraculous wisdom. He will be a Wonderful Counselor. He will possess divine power. He will be Mighty God. He will demonstrate a supernatural love. He will be the Everlasting Father. And he will introduce the Messianic Shalom. He will be the Prince of Peace. And with his monarchy, all the ancient promises to David's dynasty, which Ahaz had forfeited by his unbelief, could be fulfilled. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. And all this, says Isaiah, not the result of human manipulation, plotting and conniving. Now, all this would be God's achievement. God's sovereign, single-handed initiative, the result of his passionate commitment to his chosen people, the zeal of the Lord Almighty, will accomplish. That's why you, Isaiah, must be patient. You can't accelerate this coming day. This baby's birthday is fixed in the diary of God. You must wait for it. You must put your faith in the Lord, who for the moment is hiding his face from the house of Jacob. And keep your eyes on those children he's given you. They are signs and symbols in Israel from the Lord Almighty. One day, a child just like them will be born. Only he will be more than just an infant sermon. He will be an infant savior. Well, what are we to learn from a passage like that? There's an awful lot to digest, isn't there? Even if we were to go no further, I think, just the fascination of seeing how God brought this man through his personal experiences, through his family experiences, into this profound prophetic insight of when and how the birth of God's Messiah would be born, would take place. That, I think, is quite spellbinding. It's fascinating to see how God led these prophets to the insight they had about the Messiah's coming. But there is, of course, an enormously practical lesson underlying this quartet of babies that Isaiah presents to us. One way or another, all four of these babies are making the same point. What quality is God looking for in us human beings? Whether we be kings like Ahaz, who are prepared and privileged to play a role in the affairs of state, whether we be prophets like Isaiah, commissioned to preach the word of God, or whether we be rank and file ordinary people caught up in the consequences of international conflict and political intrigue and feeling a bit helpless about it. What is God looking for from all of us? Or whether it be the 8th century BC or the 20th century AD, of course, the answer is the same. He's looking for faith. Now, you remember what he told Ahaz, verse 9 of chapter 7? If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. It's a kind of pun. You want security, you want to stand firm. Well, the only kind of real security there is, Ahaz, is security in God, faith. If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. And that, you see, is a lesson of immense relevance. It is the lesson of Emmanuel, God with us. There are people in this world whose hope finally is pledged to that child's name, Emmanuel, God with us. There are others who seek one way or another to save themselves. Ahaz is a representative of the latter. Isaiah is a model of the former. Into one or other company we fall today. We're either like Ahaz, people who look after our own lives, do our own thing, manipulate events the best we can, save ourselves. Or we're people who believe in Emmanuel, God with us. It's a lesson our society needs to learn, because just like Judah in the 8th century, we suffer from political paranoia today, don't we? Conspiracy, everything these people call conspiracy, we read about in verse 12. We've heard enough about that, conspiracy in the White House, conspiracy in the BBC, conspiracy in the Middle East. People are frightened today, paranoid today. Like Ahaz, they tremble, like the trees of the forest shaken by the wind. We want security. And of course, the danger is that in our quest for security, we will simply invite the very disaster that we most fear. I'm a great believer in NATO myself. But there are times when it's altogether too much like the Syrian-Israelite coalition for comfort. It would reassure me immensely if I really thought the chiefs of staff of the Allied forces in Europe, like Cromwell, put their trust in God first and gunpowder second. For God is looking for faith. If you do not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all, he says. It's a lesson we Christians need to learn too. Like Isaiah, it's difficult to go on believing in dark days. And the church in the West in our century has passed through very dark days. Unbelief is rife in our society. The miseries of two world wars, the corrosive influence of atheistic ideology and philosophy, the hypocrisy and compromise of the institutional church, all these things have combined to cause many people to stumble at the religion of their forefathers. And the result is that just as in apostate Judah, we find occultism taking the place of true religion. People consult mediums and spiritualists and dabble in black magic and tarot cards and Ouija boards and horoscopes and the like. The whole paraphernalia of pagan superstition, which we once thought modern science had done away with once and for all, has swept back with a vengeance in our day. Because people have no faith. John Humphreys was speaking about this last Sunday night, and I know that some of you were disturbed by that. It may be some of you need to talk to somebody about the feelings of disturbance that were awakened in you last Sunday evening. Whether we have personally dabbled in this kind of occultism or not, what the church is to do in an age where superstition and unbelief holds the floor is quite simple. Bind up the testimony. Seal up the law among my disciples. I will wait for the Lord. Like the disciples of Isaiah, we have to guard the Bible within the community of faith. Even if that community seems pathetically small in numerical terms. It is always in the remnant of believing men and women that God's ultimate purpose lies. That's what Isaiah had to believe. That's what he had to cling to. Like Isaiah, we have to preach against the unbelief of our day. We have to warn men and women of the dangers of occultism. But supremely, we have to demonstrate within our own lives the patience that waits for the vindication of God's promises, even through the darkest hours. God is looking for faith. If you will not stand firm in your faith, you will not stand at all. But perhaps we ought to say too that there's an application of this fundamental lesson of the four babies of Isaiah to any non-Christian here. See, Ahaz is really an example, a classic example of the hardened heart. Ahaz's unbelief wasn't merely a state of ignorance, nor even of weakness. It was a state of deliberate choice. He had made up his mind, and no miracle on earth was ever going to make him change it. Dare I ask whether that's how it is perhaps with some of us? Oh, we like to make out, don't we, that our problem with Christianity is all intellectual. It's the evidence we want. Prove to me it's true, we say. I used to say that myself once. But then one day God humbled me enough to realize that the real problem didn't lie in the realm of the intellect at all. Like Ahaz, it lay in the realm of the will. I had a vested interest in my unbelief. I didn't want Christianity to be true. The implications of its truth were far too disturbing. The reason God gave me no miracle was because deep down in my heart, it wasn't a miracle I needed. It was moral surrender. The willingness to let go the reins of my own self-determination, my own plans. Isn't that the same with so many of us? We don't like it when the Word of God invades our man-made security and says, no, you have to trust God instead. We prefer to live in our fantasy world rather than face up to the real world, where God is. What would it take to make you a Christian? What sign do you need to see? God is telling us this morning that he's given us a sign. The same sign he gave Ahaz. A virgin has conceived and borne a son. To us a child is born, a son is given. That baby cradled in the manger, that man hanging on the cross, that Lord risen in glory. He is God's sign to you and me. He is Emmanuel, God with us. And he invites us to put our faith in him this morning. Let's pray together.